For the announcements and the sermon, Mr. Melvin Rhodes.
Many of you will remember the historian Paul Johnson, who on occasion was interviewed in the Baltimore television program and also was interviewed in some of the publications that we had back in those days, long ago. Recently I read an article by him, last week in fact, in which he was looking back on the 20th century and listed the people that he considered the greatest of the century, the three who had had the biggest, most beneficial impact in terms of changing the world in a positive direction. Now, I'm not saying I agree with the three that he chose. I'm just telling you the people that he chose. It's a fitting introduction to the sermon that I'm giving. I would not have chosen these three, and maybe one might have been in there, but anyway, everybody's entitled to their own opinions. Some people might even think that Elvis Presley was the greatest man of the 20th century. Somebody's going to come up to me after the service and say, "You mean he wasn't?" But anyway, Paul Johnson placed in first position Lee Kuan Yew, who was the long-serving Prime Minister of Singapore. Singapore is perhaps the greatest of all third world success stories. It got its independence in 1957 at the same time as Ghana. And while Ghana went in one direction, Singapore went in the other direction, up, and became a very successful economy, and today ranks with Western nations as one of the richest places in the world. Now, admittedly, it's been at a cost in personal freedom, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, which are all somewhat restricted in Singapore. Paul Johnson's second choice was Margaret Thatcher, whose impact stretched far beyond Britain's shores. She showed that the progressive leftward lurch of most Western countries since World War II was reversible, and that private enterprise could do almost everything better than any government could do. She was in Prague just a few days ago, being feted by the country's leadership and being described as the mother of their revolution. She contributed greatly to the changes that took place in Eastern Europe. His third choice was more predictable and is really where we're going to concentrate in this sermon. His third choice was more predictable simply because Paul Johnson, 10 or 15 years ago, converted from the Church of England, which he was disillusioned with as a result of its progressive liberalization on just about every issue imaginable. He converted to the Roman Catholic Church, as many Western intellectuals have done over the past 10, 15, 20 years. So I think it was inevitable that his third choice here, as a person who changed the world in a positive way more than others, his third choice is Pope John Paul II, who has been Pope for more than 21 years and is determined to see in the new millennium what he calls the third millennium of the Christian era, which is only 4 weeks away. Now, why John Paul II? The Pope is universally acknowledged as the man most responsible for the overthrow of communism in Eastern Europe. The biggest compliment paid to him was by the Soviets themselves when they arranged through their Bulgarian satellite to have him assassinated by a Turk. That was a compliment to him because it showed what a big threat he was considered by the communists in Eastern Europe, in Moscow in particular. The Pope, though, turned the tables on them. Not only did he survive, but he also went into the prison to meet his assassin in an act of public forgiveness that, added to his other accomplishments, raised him to the status of a living saint. Probably there is nobody in the world at this time who is more respected than the present Pope, John Paul II. Now, all three of these people are people who made a big difference, all in a positive way, at least in worldly terms. The role of the first two is essentially over. But the third has big plans. Plans that take us all well into the third millennium of the Christian era. Plans that will have a profound effect on the people of God. It's often been said that the Catholic Church has a long memory. It's also true to say that it looks forward long term rather than short term, which is the way that we have been conditioned to think in Western civilization. If it takes 200 years and 20 popes to achieve a goal, that's how long it takes. Now, it's difficult for us to grasp that mentality. It is similar to the mentality the Chinese have. I mentioned to you before how when Henry Kissinger visited China, Mao Zedong, the communist founder of China, was asked a question by Henry Kissinger. Kissinger's question was, "What do you think of the United States?" And Mao's response was, "It's too early to tell. America is a young country compared to China, and whether America works or not, we won't be able to decide for at least another 800 years. That's the kind of reasoning that the Chinese would have. And the Catholic Church is very similar. The Pope looks back on 2,000 years of Christianity. In his mind, the Catholic Church is the church that Jesus Christ founded through the Apostle Peter. Turn to Matthew chapter 16. I want to just mention something here. I discovered this at my mother's funeral, of all places, because one of the people that came to her funeral was a Seventh-day Adventist minister that my parents have known for about 40 years, that I knew him as well when I was a child growing up in England. And we got to talking about things. I mean, he knows the church that I'm a member of, and he knows where we disagree theologically. And in talking about the Sabbath and Sunday observance and the dangers which are now being posed, the threats which are developing to people who observe the seventh-day Sabbath in the European Union countries, where legislation is being considered that will introduce a statutory six-day week, which would, of course, have an adverse effect on many of our people. We were talking about that, and he mentioned something to me that just blew me away. He said, the Pope's sister is a member of our church, the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Krakow in Poland. And that's interesting. I thought that was very interesting. I haven't really thought it through to what extent it might mean or how it might impact things, but the Pope is absolutely convinced of Catholic doctrine, and his sister is a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So, that's an interesting point right there. But Matthew chapter 16 and verse 18. This is where Peter confesses Jesus as the Christ. And in verse 18, Christ says, "I say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Now, I think we understand that what is being said here is a play on words. You are Peter, a little stone, and upon this rock, meaning myself, Jesus Christ, I will build my church. So the interpretation of the Catholic Church and of the churches that have come out of her is that Peter, the church was being built upon Peter. He was the first pope, supposedly, and the church foundation was laid by him in that sense. "And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven." If you go to the Vatican, you look at the flag of the Vatican City, it is two keys. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." In other words, the church has total, absolute authority. Whatever the church decides is bound in heaven. Even heaven changes as a result of whatever the church decides. The descendants of St. Peter, the first pope. Now, this is how most people, most professing Christians, interpret this particular passage. Now, we have a different understanding of it, obviously, but that's the way most people interpret it. Now, the first millennia was 1,000 years of expansion of the church in Europe. The Christianization of the continent took place in that first 1,000 years from the time of Jesus Christ, right up until pretty much the end of the first millennia, because the Russians and the Ukrainians were not converted until 988, or when their leader became a Christian and forced everybody else in the country to be baptized as well. That was the way the Russians and the Ukrainians did it. So it took the first 1,000 years. To him, that's a positive development, to the Pope, the Christianization of Europe in that first millennia, the first 1,000 years. But the second millennia has been a disappointment, because the second millennia is the millennia of division. In 1054, shortly after the beginning of the second millennia, you saw the Eastern Schism take place, the major split in the church between East and West. The Eastern churches becoming what we call today the Orthodox churches. They broke away from the mother church in Rome and went their own way. They have some differences with the mother church, with the Catholic church based in Rome. They do have some doctrinal differences, but essentially their beliefs are the same. 500 years later, remember I said that, you know, people look back thousands of years, not just a couple of decades, but hundreds and thousands of years. So the second millennia was a millennia of division. The first division was this breach with the Orthodox churches. The second division was in the Western church itself, when the Protestant churches broke away from the mother church in the 1500s. Two divisions. This pope wants to bring these three great branches of the Christian family together under the authority of the papacy. He has declared the third millennium the millennium of reconciliation, of Christian unity. And not only Christian unity, he's also reaching out to other religions, especially Judaism and Islam, sharers, so to speak, of the same God. The Pope's ultimate goal is one world religion under the papacy. I want to read to you from the Pope's apostolic letter titled The Coming of the Third Millennium. Among the most fervent petitions which the Church makes to the Lord during this important time, as the eve of the new millennium approaches, is that unity among all Christians of the various confessions will increase until they reach full communion. The approaching end of the second millennium demands of everyone an examination of conscience and the promoting of fitting ecumenical initiatives, so that we can celebrate the great jubilee of the year 2000, if not completely united, at least much closer to overcoming the divisions of the second millennium. The ecumenical and universal character of the sacred jubilee can be fittingly reflected by a meeting of all Christians. You notice some of the wording. The need to examine conscience. Why are we divided? You know, why is it that there exist Catholic and Protestant churches and Orthodox churches when essentially they all believe the same thing? So why are there divisions? Examine your conscience. And next year, starting 4 weeks from today, on January the 1st, the year 2000, when the Church celebrates the great jubilee year of the year 2000, people should be examining themselves and asking why they're not united and striving for unity. Incredible changes have already taken place. Changes in attitude that are quite amazing. Take England, for example. In the 1500s, you had the Reformation. That was when the people broke away from the Mother Church at Rome. They were called Protestants because they were Protestants, against the government of the church, which they considered to be corrupt. The result was a country badly divided, much violence, hundreds of people burned at the stake by both sides, and eventually the country became a Protestant kingdom, and the Catholic Church was outlawed, it was banned. In 1605, there was a plot by closet Catholics to kill the king and bring down Parliament with them. It was called the Gunpowder Plot. A lot of gunpowder was gradually placed under the Parliament building, and on the day that the King went to open Parliament, on November the 5th, they were going to blow it up with him and all the lords and ladies gathered together. In fact, in England, still, every year on November the 5th, people celebrate this, the fact that the plotters got caught. And the man who was behind the plot was called Guy Fawkes. This is where we get the word Guy from, because ever since then, an effigy of Guy Fawkes has been made every year and burned publicly on November the 5th. I have to admit that I did this for the first 10 or 15 years of my life. I don't do it anymore, but You know, it was one way of keeping warm in the middle of November. Put it that way. So even after almost 400 years, it's still remembered. The church was banned until the 1800s. Still today, a Catholic cannot sit on the throne or be married to someone on the throne. Listen to what Christianity Today had to say in a recent issue. Anglican and Roman Catholic leaders in May of this year released a consensus statement on the papacy, saying it is a gift to be received by all the churches. Archbishop of Canterbury, George Carey, says recognizing the Pope's role as a spiritual leader is an important task for all Christians. An urgent task, actually, not important, he said urgent. It is an urgent task for all Christians to recognize the supremacy of the Pope as the spiritual leader of all Christians. We've come a long way from a time when the church was banned to where now religious leaders are calling on all Christians to recognize the Pope as the spiritual head of all Christians. 2 months later, the Pope, doing his bit to move his church closer to the Protestants without undermining the authority of the papacy, which is the most important consideration in all of this, the authority of the papacy, declared that heaven is not a physical place, but a relationship with God. Hell, instead of being an actual place, is a state of those who freely and definitely separate themselves from God. This moves the Catholic Church more towards the Lutheran position. You see, there can be compromise on doctrine. There cannot be compromise on the supremacy of the papacy, which is a political institution more than anything. In October, Lutherans and Catholics took a step toward reconciliation by signing a joint declaration on the doctrine of justification. I'm quoting here, the accord was signed on Reformation Sunday. The significance in that day, the day on which Lutherans remember the Reformation, the breaking away from the Mother Church, the accord was signed on Reformation Sunday by senior clerics in the German city of Augsburg, where Martin Luther at one time lived. You see the symbolism here. Like now, after 500 years, it's time to come back together. It marked a symbolic end to a theological dispute which triggered the Protestant Reformation almost 500 years ago. Luther's thesis led to a religious revolution which divided much of Christian Europe and provoked decades of war. End of quote. The Pope hailed the previous draft of this accord by describing it as an important ecumenical achievement that will encourage and reinforce the declared aim that Lutherans and Catholics pursue the achievement of visible full unity. Religious leaders can look to Scripture to justify Christian unity. Look at Zechariah chapter 12, for example. Chapter 14 and verse 9. The Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day it shall be the Lord is one and his name one. Interpreted as the church will come together and be one. All Christians will come together and be one. Out of those three great branches of Christianity, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox. It's a prophecy, and the belief is that they're working towards the fulfillment of that prophecy and other prophecies as well. Yet is this what God wants? And how will it impact us in the churches of God? Interestingly, in striving for religious unity, there are four common areas being stressed. Listen carefully to these four areas that are being stressed in these stepping stones to Christian unity, these building blocks, if you like, that are being built as progressively the churches come together to form one united church under the papacy. These are the four building blocks, the four common areas being stressed. Sunday observance, number one. Just think for a moment of the impact that might have on Christians who are not in agreement. Sunday observance, number one. Secondly, Trinitarianism, the second big building block here. Thirdly, communion. the Lord's Supper, Passover, Eucharist, Mass, whatever you want to call it. Fourthly, the liturgy. Where do we fit in here? I don't have to tell you that these are four areas where we are at variance with mainstream Christianity, and that greater unity between the various churches on these issues could give us some serious problems. Let's take a look at each of these four areas. Sunday observance, the common bond that unites almost all people professing Christianity. In his letter titled The Lord's Day, John Paul II stated, "The coming of the third millennium, which calls believers to reflect upon the course of history in the light of Christ, also invites them to rediscover with new intensity the meaning of Sunday, its mystery, its celebration, its significance for Christian and human life." End of quote. During the year 2000, plans are being made in Rome for many joint services to be held, with hundreds of different denominations meeting together. Over 200 different denominations are meeting together in Rome in the year 2000. All Sunday observing churches, building on the unity which the observance of Sunday gives to them. The recent accord between Lutherans and Catholics took place while they celebrated a joint service on a Sunday. Associated Press said this on the 1st of November, just 5 weeks ago. "Putting aside five centuries of differences in theology, Roman Catholic and Lutheran church leaders embraced at a service Sunday, where they signed a declaration ending a dispute over salvation that sparked the Protestant Reformation and led to the 30 Years' War. The prayer service and signing ceremony include representatives of 24 countries where Lutherans and Catholics have a big presence. Sunday is seen as a central belief of all Christians, of all of those ecumenical people who want unity. Nonconformists like ourselves and the Seventh-day Adventists, and presumably even the Pope's sister, come under greater condemnation. If all these other Christian churches can come together and resolve all of their differences, then why can't we come together with them and resolve our differences?" You see the thinking? Therefore, we just must be a bunch of argumentative, confrontational, self-righteous, disagreeable types. Of course, some people are, but I mean, you know... Not everybody is. The Bible shows that the seventh day Sabbath is a sign of God's people, not the first day, not Sunday. Look at Exodus 31. Exodus chapter 31 and verse 12. See, in three places, note the link with the Trinity there, in Rome, in the Holy Land, and in the local church. Especially in this phase, the phase of celebration, the aim will be to give glory to the Trinity, from whom everything in the world and in history comes, and to whom everything returns. The teaching of the Trinity has long been a major doctrine of mainstream churches. Since 381 AD, at the Council of Constantinople, those who do not believe in the Trinity have been condemned as heretics. And until the ascendancy of the Israelite powers in the 1700s, people who did not believe in the Trinity generally were put to death. That was the punishment. There was a documentary some years ago on the Learning Channel on the history of Christianity, and one whole episode was devoted to the Trinity. And they claimed in that program, and I've never looked into this to check it up, so maybe somebody who's got lots of time on their hands might want to do so, but they claimed in the program that no other issue in religion, no other religious issue, has caused so many deaths as the Trinity. In the second century in particular, you know, tens of thousands of people were killing each other over this one doctrinal dispute, the issue of the Trinity. If somebody could check that, I'd be interested in hearing the results of your research. I don't believe everything I hear on television. 1 John chapter 5. Might be better to say I don't believe anything I hear on television. That you might be more impressed. But 1 John chapter 5. This is the only reference in the New Testament to the Trinity as such. And if you look in any commentary, you'll find that this was added in the 5th century AD. It was in the Latin Vulgate edition of the scriptures, which came out in the 400s. Incidentally, just after that decision made at the Council of Constantinople in 381. So it's just after that. They had to put something in about the Trinity to back up the decision that had been made. For there are three, it says in verse 7, who bear witness in heaven. Now, beginning with the next word, this is not in the original Greek scriptures. The Father, the Word, and the Holy Spirit, and these three are one. And there are three that bear witness on earth. End of the passage which is inserted. Those words were all added. The Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three agree as one. Take away what was added, and again, there's nothing there to support the idea of a Trinity. So Trinitarianism is not biblical. The concept of the Trinity is not biblical. But it is common to all mainstream churches and heavily emphasized. It's a mystery. It's not something that we are meant to understand. It's meant to be a mystery beyond human comprehension. The third area where common ground is being sought in order for Christian unity to be achieved is in the area of the communion service, or Eucharist, or Mass. Here's the Pope again. I'm quoting from The Coming of the Third Millennium. The year 2000 will be intensely Eucharistic in the sacrament of the Eucharist. The Savior who took flesh in Mary's womb 20 centuries ago continues to offer himself to humanity as the source of divine life. The ecumenical and universal character of the sacred Jubilee can be fittingly reflected by a meeting of all Christians. This would be an event of great significance, and so in order to avoid misunderstandings, it should be properly presented and carefully prepared in an attitude of fraternal cooperation with Christians of other denominations and traditions, as well as of grateful openness to those religions whose representatives might wish to acknowledge the joy shared by all the disciples of Christ. In summation, that one paragraph is saying that all churches will be sharing in the communion cup of Rome. That hasn't been the case in the past. I went to a Catholic wedding. I've been to a few Catholic weddings, but one I went to the most recently, I remember most vividly, and that was where there was a mass beforehand, and when it came to the time for everybody to go forward and receive the bread and the wine, it was made clear that non-Catholics were not welcome. That is going to change as a result of this drive for ecumenicalism. But what is interesting is the change doesn't come until people accept the supremacy of the papacy. That's when the change comes. Once people recognize the Pope as the supreme spiritual authority, then the church can be absorbed, even if some of its traditions might be a bit different. I mean, in the Uniate Church, for example, in Ukraine, which is a Catholic church, priests can marry. They always have been able to in the Ukraine, but they can't in Italy or France or Germany or anywhere else. Now, it doesn't matter. They're perfectly willing to let the Ukraine have a different doctrine on celibacy as long as they recognize the supreme authority of the Pope. Lutherans and Anglicans already have similar communion services. Most Protestants can partake of communion in other Protestant churches if they want to. Dave Hunt wrote a book called A Woman Rides the Beast in 1994, and I quote here from that book. Martin Luther was unable to shake free from much of his Roman Catholicism, infant baptism, etc. I mean, a lot of the beliefs didn't change. and he remains within the church that bears his name to this day. While denying that they teach transubstantiation, Lutherans declare the true, real body and blood of Christ are somehow present in a unique way in, with, and under the bread and wine which are set aside. You know, in Catholic doctrine, they believe in transubstantiation. But when you take the bread, it is literally the body of Jesus Christ, somehow transformed, transubstantiated, so to speak. And the Protestants believe it's all symbolic. The Lutherans declare the true, real body and blood of Christ are somehow present in a unique way, in, with, and under the bread and wine which are set aside. So, a slight difference of emphasis. Augsburg played a significant role in the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther lived there for a time. It was also where the two sides met to try to reconcile over 400 years ago under the auspices of the Holy Roman Emperor. So it's very significant that this ancient city was chosen this year as the meeting place for this big jump toward Christian unity between Lutherans and Catholics. The Catholic Church wants to build on this by reaching out to other Protestants. And I quote from the Christian Science Monitor, the 29th of October this year. To Catholics, full communion means everybody is in communion with the bishops who are in communion with the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. Pope Pius XII, and I want to continue this maybe next week, maybe the week after. I've been reading a very good book, which I haven't finished yet, called Hitler's Pope, about Pope Pius XII, and it shows just how much the Church was involved in the Third Reich and how much the Church was involved in the Holocaust. The murders of 6 million Jews. And Pope Pius XII was the Pope at that particular time. Pope Pius XII, in his document Mystici Corpus in 1943, in the middle of World War II, said this: "We must not pass over in silence or veil in ambiguous terms the truth of Catholic teaching, that the only true union is by the return of separated Christians to the one true Church of Christ. For those who do not belong to the visible body of the Church, none can be assured of eternal salvation because they are still deprived of the helps and heavenly favors found only inside the Catholic Church." See, a belief that there is only one Church. There is only one way to salvation, and that is through the one Church. And everybody must come under the authority of that Church, which means under the authority of the man at the top. Now, I think many of you will be thinking about different scriptures that prophesy a great deal of this is going to happen. I'm going to look at those in the next sermon that I give as I continue this. But let's just go back to that issue of the Eucharist again, the communion service, or what we would call the Passover. Look at 1 Corinthians 5. The early Christians did not keep the Eucharist as mainstream Christianity does. They kept what we keep, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7 and 8, where the Apostle Paul writes about the sins in the church there. He says, "Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, the Passover, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." Not a weekly communion service, or a Mass, or a Eucharist, but the Passover service, which was kept once a year. The fourth area where unity is being built is in the area of the liturgy, or formal prayer. Webster's Dictionary defines liturgy as this: a rite, R-I-T-E, like rite aid, a rite or body of rites prescribed for public worship. These are similar in Catholic and many Protestant churches. The liturgy is similar in the different churches. On October the 4th, 1998, so just over a year ago, the rites of some Protestant churches were unified. Members of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian Church, the Reformed Church, and the United Church of Christ agreed to share ministers, sacraments, and members. Christianity Today reported on this
in November of 1998 and wrote the following. The service opened with a four-way processional leading to a central baptismal font, the symbol of the basic sacrament of membership in each of the bodies, a common recitation of the Nicene Creed, and a renewal of baptismal vows emphasize common beliefs each tradition holds. Now note John Paul II's emphasis on the commonality of the liturgy of many Catholic and Protestant churches in his paper, The Coming of the Third Millennium. I therefore decree that the great jubilee of the year 2000 will begin on Christmas Eve 1999, less than 3 weeks away. At St. Paul's Basilica, the Holy Door will be opened on Tuesday, January 18th, when the week of prayer for Christian unity begins, as a way of emphasizing the distinctive ecumenical character of this jubilee. End of quote. Ecumenicalism is the bringing of all the churches together. And this is the emphasis with the new century. The liturgy is the set prayers and set traditions, the ritual, if you like, of the church service of the various churches. Those of you who came out of other churches will know that they have a liturgy. I mean, we used to repeat the Lord's Prayer every week in the Methodist Church and, you know, do a few other things, repeat the Apostles' Creed and things like that every week. Now, what about those who believe that prayer should be in private? Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Now, some of you may believe that, you know, there's no threat to private prayer. But, believe me, there can be. And, again, I'm not saying these things would change automatically, but, you know, sometimes I think we can think that, you know, we're protected by separation of church and state, etc. But, you know, you look back at history and you see that until fairly recently, when it came to keeping the Sabbath, I mean, Sunday was, you know, it wasn't exactly legislated in law, but Sunday was the day of rest until the 1960s. And, you know, if you were in industry or in business, too bad. It was a six-day work week. And, you know, that could happen again. Matthew chapter 5, chapter 6, beginning of verse 5, when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. You see, Christ condemned this this public prayer. It's not that a prayer in public is a sin in itself, because Christ also prayed in public, you know, leading the people, asking the blessing on food and so on. So it's not wrong for us to have a prayer at the beginning of the service and at the end of the service. But essentially, as this passage shows, prayer is meant to be in private. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward, those who want to pray in public to be seen by others. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in the secret place. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. Look at Daniel. Daniel chapter 6. You know, you remember the example of Daniel here in Daniel chapter 6. You know how the plot was devised against Daniel. In verse 7 it says, all the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. This was the decision. In other words, no religious freedom. The king had to be worshipped, which is quite normal even today in some countries. The king or the leader of the nation is worshipped. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the laws of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. And in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. They reminded the king that it was illegal to pray in private to any god other than the king. And Daniel ended up almost being a meal for a few lions, because God protected him. But, you know, we have to be concerned about some of these developments. Acts chapter 5 shows that we could be placed in this position. Acts 5 verse 29, where Peter and the apostle said we ought to obey God rather than man. No, should we? We should obey God rather than man if any of these decrees should come into effect. In the European Union, legislation is being debated on working hours. And, you know, there has been a constant criticism by the church, you know, as far as Sunday observance goes. I mean, recently, part of the World Cup, the international soccer tournament, one of the crucial games was on a Sunday. And the French government was asked by the Vatican to stop the game because Sunday is a day of rest. You know, they didn't stop it because at the present time, the mood of most people is very secular. But there has been this kind of build-up, an increased interference, if you like, increased pressure from the church to reinstitute Sunday. And there's some sense in it because, you know, when you look at the way society is, where most people now busy and active 7 days a week, they have no time to rest, and their families suffer, their health suffers. So there is some sense on a legislated day of rest. But if it comes, you know, it won't be the seventh day of the week. And some of these other things too are cause for concern. But these are the four areas, the four main areas, where the church is trying to build unity between all Christians. I don't feel this could not happen in the United States. In the journal, in the last issue, there was a letter from somebody encouraging us all to get involved in politics. As a result of that, I wrote an editorial, which will be in the next issue, showing how dangerous that would be. The person who wrote his letter was suggesting we get involved with the religious right because they are against abortion and gay rights and against evolution being taught in schools and so on, and we should all get out there and vote with them. But I showed in my article that whenever a nation's government is dominated by a religious group, always religious minorities suffer. Always. And the same thing would happen with us. And don't think that the Constitution would protect us, that separation of church and state would protect us, because, you know, it wouldn't happen. There's been, you know, examples of intolerance in American history and British history as well, where, you know, that's cause for concern. How long would it be, for example, before there was a legislated day of rest if we had a government dominated by a religious faction? Now, where is all this leading, then, this striving for Christian unity? You might have noticed on the news the last few days that in Seattle they've had some riots, and those riots were directed against the World Trade Organization, the WTO. A lot of people are afraid that it's all leading to one world government. Look at Revelation chapter 19 and verse 20. We certainly see with globalization this coming together of different nations. You know, the World Trade Organization is essentially about free trade, not about developing one world government. But it's interesting just to look at some scriptures here in this light. In Revelation 19, verse 20, it says, "The beast was captured, and with him the false prophet, who works signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were cast alive in the lake of fire burning with brimstone." You know, here's a passage warning about the beast and the false prophet. And there's a warning for God's people to come out of her. Look at Revelation 13. Go back to chapter 13. Look at verse 14. "He deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived." Talking about false religion and the false church-state system. In verse 8, "All who dwell on the earth will worship him whose names have not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." You know, this is talking about world domination by the beast power and the false church in this passage. And again, calling on God's people to come out of her. Revelation 18. Revelation 18 talks about an economic system that brings all nations together. and also in the context of all these other passages, a religious system that goes with it. You know, so we are moving in this direction towards, you know, one universal church. That's what the word Catholic means, universal, one universal church and one universal governmental authority. Revelation 18 verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, the false church. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. I want to quote from John Paul II again. On the basis of this profound renewal, the striving for unity amongst all the different churches, the Catholic Council opened itself to Christians of other denominations, to the followers of other religions, and to all the people of our time. Seen in this light, the whole of Christian history appears to us a single river. The whole 2,000 years, again, how many of us look back in thousands of years and see a trend in history? But here the Pope does that. Seen in this light, the whole of Christian history appears to us a single river into which many tributaries pour their waters. The year 2000 invites us with renewed fidelity and even deeper communion along the banks of this great river. Just like you get all these, you know, little rivers that lead into the big river, so all the different churches will come into the big church, which is going in a certain direction. Of course, a lot of this has been made possible by the present Pope, Pope John Paul II, because he is, as I said earlier, probably the most respected person in the world at this time. Now, if you look at Hitler's Pope, the book on Pius XII, you'll see how the church, even very recently, was involved in some very evil things. But, you know, at this present time, the most respected man in the world happens to be in that same office. And a lot of people forget some of the lessons of history and how our ancestors struggled for hundreds of years for religious freedom, and how many people died because they believed that the Trinity, for example, was not biblically correct, because they wanted the right to pray in private, in English. You know, it was punishable by death to pray in English not so long ago. You know, a lot of people struggled to give us these freedoms. And now some of these churches think, oh, well, you know, they don't really care too much. Perhaps they don't even know the history. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 14 talks about how Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. Therefore it is no great thing if his ministers also transform themselves into ministers of righteousness, whose end will be according to their works. So it is a great deception which was prophesied here. Now, some of the material I've used today is from an article by Mario Siegley, who writes for the Good News and World News and Prophecy, and it may appear in the next World News and Prophecy, but it tied in very much with the book that I've been reading that I would like to share with you on a future occasion. And Mario Siegley, at the end of his article, writes this. One wonders which river he has in mind, talking about this, these tributaries that run into the single river. One wonders which river he has in mind. Unwittingly, he's given a spiritual description of the great river in Babylon, the Euphrates, which spreads far and wide and symbolically is the place where Rome wants all religions to finally converge. Already, ecumenism is reaching out to Buddhists, Hindus, and even pantheistic groups. See, a desire to encompass all religions. A number of Christians have been murdered in India in the last few months, and the Pope was there just a week or so ago. And at a time when a nationalist Hindu government is very much against Christianity and foreign influence, the Pope called upon his followers in India to convert all the people of India. So, you know, a deliberate provocation to the Indians. There's 1 billion Indians, and, you know, about 800 million of them are Hindus, about 150 million Muslims, and then a few Christians and others there. So, you know, but here the desire again is to bring all religions into this one world religion. Dave Hunt writes in his book, A Woman Rides the Beast, one of John Paul II's most amazing feats was the gathering at Assisi in Italy in 1986 of 130 leaders of the world's 12 major religions to pray for peace. Praying together were snake worshippers, fire worshippers, spiritists, animists, North American witch doctors, Buddhists, Muslims and Hindus, as well as Christians and Catholics. The Pope declared that all were praying to the same God, which is the general frame of mind that most people have today. The question ecumenism poses is, from which river shall we drink? Will the nations drink from the grand and popular one flowing from a spiritual Babylon? You know, look at Revelation 17 and verse 1, and it talks about how this false religion sits upon many waters. I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters all over the world. Or will they drink from the small but pure river flowing from the unpolluted principles of the Holy Land? Prophecy shows that the spiritual deception on the world is going to increase with greater emphasis beginning with the turn of a new millennium, that the elect of God will understand the difference between true religion and false. But we need to make sure we're firmly grounded in what we believe, that we're not going to be deceived. Those areas that we looked at, Sunday observance, Trinitarianism, ecumenism, the communion, and the liturgy, those four, all building blocks of ecumenism, are areas we need to be well versed in what the scriptures say, so that we are ready always to give an answer, realizing the trend, the direction in which mainstream religion is going at this time, as we embark upon the third millennium of the Christian era, the millennium of Christian unity, of reconciliation between the different branches of mainstream Christianity. Well, let's try and get started on the